listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, with studios in Eager, Arizona, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 FM stations across the nation and around the world.
I'm Pooh.
And I'm William Cooper.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, my dear. And thank you so much. I thought you were never going to come back and say the pledge ever again.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Well, you just took a little holiday, huh?
Probably.
Okay.
Oh, a break.
Okay. I'll come in and tuck you in later.
All right, bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight is another first for the Hour of the Time. As you know, I always do my own research, cite my own sources, and give you the findings therefrom. I have only deviated from that twice in the history of the Hour of the Time, once for Perceptions Magazine, and for Backwards Home Magazine, both of which I highly recommend, because amongst all of the other things, there are great kernels of truth and methods of becoming self-sufficient and understanding those with whom you normally do not associate. I think that's important because part of the tactic of the enemy is to divide and conquer. So where you look around and you see your neighbor as your enemy because you have been taught to believe that way, or television tells you that, or something happens that you read that you are not supposed to associate with that kind of person, usually when you break through all of those boundaries, artificial boundaries, if you will, you'll find that they're just people like you trying to make a living like everybody else. And that these barriers and these animosities and these problems are built intentionally to divide us in order to conquer us. Tonight I'm going to read an article to you from Relevance magazine. It's one of my favorites, and I think the introduction that I gave to tonight's broadcast should tell you how important that is. Philip O'Halloran, who is the editor of Relevance magazine, is a personal friend of mine. In my recent trip to the state of Michigan for my speaking engagement, I had an opportunity to sit down and have dinner with Philip and Connie and many other people from Michigan who are important people, who are patriots, who care about this country, who care about God, and who are fighting to prevent the loss of freedom for all peoples, no matter race, religion, or place of ancestral origin. So I'm going to read you this article from Relevance magazine tonight. And I'm going to tell you how to subscribe to this magazine right now. You can call 1-800-626-8944. That's 1-800-626-8944. Once again, 1-800-626-8944. A year subscription is $110, ladies and gentlemen. Now, the very best publication that you can subscribe to in this world is Veritas Newspaper, a full-size newspaper. And a lot of the articles that are written in Relevance appear previously as headline articles in Veritas Newspaper. Not word for word, not written by the same people, and not researched by the same people. So it's not exactly the same article. But you always get it first from Veritas. Now, whether you get it first, second, third, fourth, or fifth, Relevance magazine is one of the best places to get any information that you can get, because the research is impeccable. The writing is excellent. And as you hear tonight, it's going to hold you on the edge of your seat. And you're going to begin to understand through this article some of the things that have been happening. And we're going to stick with Relevance magazine for this week. And if I don't finish with this article tonight, I will continue tomorrow night. On Friday, April 26th, agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms arrested the leader of the Georgia Republic Militia and an associate on the charge of conspiring, quote, to possess unregistered explosive devices, or more specifically, pipe bombs. Naturally, the disturbing news was splashed across the nation and even made international headlines. When CBS News claimed, and listen very closely, ladies and gentlemen, that the militiamen had plotted to use the bombs in a terrorist act aimed at the upcoming Olympics in Atlanta. In a May 6th preliminary hearing held in Macon, Georgia, the two defendants, Robert E. Starr III and William J. McCraney, were brought before U.S. Magistrate Richard L. Hodge. At this hearing, Starr's attorney, Dr. Nancy Lord, argued that BATF confidential informants who had infiltrated the small militia group had actually planted the bomb-making material themselves. This was broken as a headline story in Veritas magazine some months ago. In fact, within 2 or 3 weeks of the arrest of McCraney and Starr, the government's case is built on the premise that Starr and McCraney had conspired to build pipe bombs, and they presented as evidence the fact that they had discovered, quote, bomb-making materials, end quote, buried in two locations in Crawford County, one where McCraney lives and another on land owned by Starr. According to militia members who have signed sworn affidavits, two men reputed to be the government's informants had discussed building the pipe bombs for home defense. The discussions occurred at an April 23rd militia meeting, after which several of the other militia members approached Starr and told him that they were opposed to the bomb-making plan discussed by the two men. They contend that Starr reassured them that he had no intention of going along with the two informants' plan. As for McCraney, the Macon, Georgia Telegraph of May 7th exposed a critical government admission revealed during the preliminary hearing. Pay very close attention, ladies and gentlemen. And I quote directly from the Macon, Georgia Telegraph of May 7th. Quote, Agent Stephen W. Gillis of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms also acknowledged that Starr's co-defendant, William James, Jimmy McCraney, had said, quote, I don't want to know anything about it, end quote, and walked away when the government's informant was talking about building bombs, end quote. Note, ladies and gentlemen, that the government informant was talking about building bombs, not Starr and not McCraney, which supports the defense's charge of entrapment. In fact, Starr's attorney, Nancy Lord, goes one step further. Lord, who was the 1992 Libertarian Party candidate for vice president, charged, quote, this is beyond entrapment. It is manufactured evidence. The materials were put on Mr. Starr's property without his knowledge. The whole evidence upon which this case was based was fraudulent, end quote. The revealing Macon Telegraph article continued, quote, a federal agent testified Monday that Starr was not present when alleged vice pipe bomb components were buried on his property, and the agent admitted that he did not know for sure whether Robert Edward Starr III was aware the materials were there, end quote. The Telegraph added that Dr. Lord accused the ATF's confidential informants of being sent in to infiltrate and set up the militia group. Quote, Lord said it was the agent provocateurs who actually buried the pipes and chemicals on Starr's property, which made it easy for agents to find them when they got a search warrant. She said, and I quote, you went right to it. You didn't have to search the whole 16 acres, did you? End quote, Lord asked. FBI agent Gillis conceded agents did not. They went in. Exactly, right to the specific spot. Lord had maintained that there is no conspiracy when all the participants but one are government agents, according to the Telegraph's Audrey Posta. Quote, Gillis had just testified that someone other than the government's informants had shown up to McCraney's place the day the materials were to be moved to Starr's property, which would have met the legal definition of a conspiracy. When Lord asked Gillis whether this other militia member actually participated in moving the materials, prosecutor Sharon Ratley objected, again citing the need to protect identities. The truth is, ladies and gentlemen, the truth is that there was no militia member. All of these materials were moved and buried at the specific sites by agents, provocateurs of the United States government being paid to do so. If they had failed in doing so, they would not have been paid. Ratley objected repeatedly when Lord pressed Agent Gillis, asking him whether anyone other than Starr and the government's informants took part in discussions or activities concerning the pipe bombs. Ratley contended that the identities of the confidential informants would then be revealed, to which Lord countered, with all due respect, the identity has been revealed. The judge finally instructed Gillis to answer the question of whether this other militia member had actually participated. The alcohol, tobacco, and firearms agent admitted, quote, I don't know what the other individual did, end quote. In fact, Gillis's evidence was based on an ambiguous tape recording. Quote, the agent acknowledged that he had no way of knowing from the informant's tape recording whether the group was talking about bombs or survival gear when members talked about needing supplies, end quote. Nevertheless, federal agent Stephen Gillis appears content to help send two men to jail for many years on these disgracefully flimsy and quite probably manufactured charges. Ohio militia leader J.J. Johnson, who attended the trial and testified as a character witness for Starr, cited the following additional holes in the government's case as they were revealed by cross-examination of Agent Gillis. One, Bob Starr did not want bomb-making materials on his property and did not have possession of any bomb-making materials. Two, there never were any completed pipe bombs, and the bomb-making factory alluded to in media reports consisted of two small sandwich bags of legally obtainable chemicals such as sodium perchlorate powder, aluminum, and a clumpy white mixture not yet analyzed. After 10 days, this is number three, after 10 days, the chemicals found on Starr's property still had not been analyzed by any scientific laboratory. If, as the hearing's evidence suggests, the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms informants planted the materials, there would be no need to test the chemicals. They would already know what they were. Four, government informants planted the evidence, the bomb-making material on Starr's property, and it has not yet been ascertained through chemical analysis that any of these chemicals, when put together, would actually make any bomb. How about that? Number five, McCraney was not at the meeting to discuss bomb making and wanted nothing to do with making bombs. In fact, observers we interviewed had no idea why the man was even being held. As Johnson's wife, Helen, asked, quote, has it occurred to anyone that the wrong guys are in jail, end quote? But ladies and gentlemen, why didn't Starr simply say no to the illegal schemes and scuttle the whole thing right from the beginning? Well, Attorney Lord claims that her client had suspected a government setup and was attempting to determine who in his militia group had instigated the talk of bomb making. He did not know whether it was the two men doing the talking or someone else, and was, according to Lord, conducting an internal investigation of the organization he founded. Lord insisted, Mr. Starr was arrested not because he intended to build those bombs, but because he intended not to. In fact, the night after the meeting where the alleged pipe bomb discussions occurred, Starr phoned in to the popular shortwave program of J.J. Johnson, himself a militia leader from Ohio. The tape is being used as evidence by the defense and has already been played to the court. Johnson told Relevance that Starr alerted the listening audience to the kind of unscrupulous tactics to expect from federal law enforcement. He made specific reference to attempts by law enforcement to infiltrate groups with agents provocateurs who might then attempt to entrap or frame the group's members with illegal acts. Starr also told Johnson off the air that a friendly FBI acquaintance had warned him earlier that day of an anonymous threat against his, Starr's, life. It was for this reason that Starr decided to refer on the air to the federal entrapment tactics. Did Starr's comments prompt the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms to hurriedly set the hook on their sting operation? Well, the Telegraph article states, and I quote, Gillis confirmed the FBI said it had received the death threat against Starr. But he said there was no connection between Starr's calling the radio show and ATF's decision to get the warrants against Starr and McCraney the next day. End quote. That's right. They obtained the arrest warrants the day after the Wednesday radio show and took the two into custody the following day. Gadsden, Alabama militia leader Jeff Randall, who, like Johnson, is a personal friend of Starr's, told Relevance, quote, look at the chronology of events. The ATF admitted that they would have had a better case if they had waited until the components were assembled, end quote. That would have been on the Saturday when the alleged bomb-making session was to take place at Starr's property. Randall believes that the only reason the men were arrested earlier, before they had any hard evidence, is that Starr's shortwave show tipped off the feds that he was on to their entrapment scheme. Randall added, quote, ATF admitted that the pipes had not even been fingerprinted and that the chemical was not tested to see if it would even explode, end quote, and therefore how can they be charged with possessing unregistered explosive material? What is going on, ladies and gentlemen? This is not standard FBI or even basic police technique. This is a frame-up. Again, you see, there would be no reason to take fingerprints or test the chemicals to see if they would explode if the agents knew that their informants alone had planted the evidence. Jeff Randall, who has been gathering information on Starr's behalf, disclosed that the defense has lined up numerous witnesses who will testify that, quote, the only ones involved in the bomb-making talk or activity were the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms informants, end quote. Randall and Johnson also revealed that the defense has obtained a copy of internal documents from the ATF showing that the confidential informants were paid to infiltrate the group. It has recently been revealed that they were paid $50,000. As to Robert Starr's record, although federal agents claimed they had investigated Starr for similar conspiracies in the past, the self-employed electrician has never been charged and has absolutely no criminal record. As to his character, Randall noted, quote, I know he's totally innocent. I wouldn't be hanging my butt on the line for somebody who was planning to make bombs. I don't support terrorists, end quote. And neither does any other legitimate militia in this country. The Macon Telegraph quoted his former office manager, Linda King, as saying, quote, I don't believe there's a mean bone in his body, end quote. Over 75 militia members and local supporters packed the courthouse for the preliminary hearing and found twice as many law enforcement officers waiting for them. What did they think they were going to do? Among their activities, quote, local, state, and federal officers snapped pictures as militia supporters quietly gathered in small groups under shade trees, end quote. Notably, the militia members snapped right back with cameras of their own, and well they should. A few weeks prior, ladies and gentlemen, to the incident, the Georgian had told Randall that he was conducting an investigation into his militia and that he wanted to meet with him to discuss at a later date. Other members of Starr's group have told Randall that the two purported government informants were the only ones who ever discussed the illegal acts. But isn't it outrageous to suggest, and I know many of you are thinking this, isn't it outrageous, insulting, to suggest that federal agents would do something so despicable as to plant evidence on innocent people in an attempt to put them behind bars for many, many years? Actually, they've done it all before, ladies and gentlemen, and worse. In 1990, Ward Churchill and Jim Vander Waal wrote the COINTELPRO papers, documents from the FBI's secret wars against dissent in the United States. The name, the term, COINTELPRO, pronounced co-in-tel-pro, is a contraction of counterintelligence program, which was, and likely still is, official denials, notwithstanding a domestic anti-dissent operation which apparently targets any group. Any group at all are groups that deviate too far from the establishment's game plan for America, which is to march directly into the New World Order, the New World totalitarian socialist state without a whimper. Remember, peace is defined by Lenin as the absence of opposition to socialism. The book used numerous references, including the huge spate of documents released during a brief congressional crackdown on our secret police agencies and others obtained under the Freedom of Information Act to chronicle federal law enforcement abuses during the 60s and 70s. The book printed one quote from Goldstein's Political Repression in Modern America, which has particular relevance to the Georgia case. And I quote directly from the book. Probably the most well-known agent provocateur was Thomas Tongyai, known as Tommy the Traveler. Tongyai, who was paid by both the FBI and local police, spent over 2 years traveling among colleges in western New York State, urging students to kill police, make bombs, and blow up buildings. He supplied students with radical speakers organized by SDS conferences in Rochester and urged students to participate in the Weatherman, quote, Days of Rage, end quote, in Chicago in October 1969. Tongyai constantly talked violence, carried a grenade in his car, showed students how to use an M1 rifle, and offered advice on how to carry out bombings. These are from pages 474 to 475, emphasis in original, from the congressional investigation on COINTELPRO. Tommy the FBI provocateur did the talking. The gullible student radicals did the listening and the dirty work. From the report again, quote, after some students at Hobart College apparently took his advice and bombed the Hobart ROTC building and Tongyai's cover was exposed, the local sheriff commented, quote, there's a lot of difference between showing how to build a bomb and building one, end quote. As a result of Tongyai's activities on the Hobart campus, 9 students and faculty faced criminal charges, but Tongyai was cleared by a local grand jury and went on to become a policeman in Pennsylvania. See, for reference, The Agent Provocateur as Folk Hero by Frank Donner and the issue of Civil Liberties dated September 1971. Political repression in modern America relates yet another of the numerous cases of FBI informants creating crimes from scratch. Quote, probably the most incredible provocation incident involved an FBI and Seattle police informer, Alfred Burnett, who lured Gary Eugene Ward into planting a bomb at a Seattle real estate office on the morning of May 15, 1970, by paying Ward $75, providing him with the bomb, and giving him transportation to the bombing scene. Page 473. Ward, a twice wounded, thrice decorated Vietnam veteran, was, quote, shot and killed by waiting Seattle police as he allegedly fled after the bombing attempt, although he was unarmed, on foot, and boxed in by police cars, end quote.
Thank you.
ladies and gentlemen, the Hour of the Time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading. Let me tell you that it is an extraordinary experience to actually hold and look at a gold coin. Whether it's a $5 gold coin piece, a $10 piece, which are very, very small, by the way. Very small. You would be surprised. You'd also be surprised at how heavy they are. Or whether it's a $20 gold piece. Have you ever held a $20 gold piece in your hand? Ladies and gentlemen, I've got to tell you that you really have an experience ahead of you. You really don't understand what money is or why it must have intrinsic value of its own until you've done this. Or until you've held a silver dollar. A silver dollar has the same effect. It's not as heavy. It's not as impressive. But nevertheless, it has weight. It has value. It has substance. It's real. It doesn't go away. And it doesn't dissolve or destruct over a period of months or years like a phony counterfeit piece of paper that you call a Federal Reserve note that you carry around in your pocket does. And if you continue to listen to this broadcast, once a month we're going to play Stephen Jacobson's Wake Up America. And I'm going to do it once a month. I don't care how many times you've heard it. You can never hear it enough. And every time you hear it, you learn something new about money, about economics, about depressions, about inflations, about all of the lies, about paper, about real metal coins. You understand the true situation that we're in once you understand Stephen Jacobson's Wake Up America. In the meantime, I want you to call Swiss America Trading and ask them for the current issue of their newsletter. Thank them for sponsoring the Hour of the Time. Thank them for sponsoring the hour before the Hour of the Time. And, of course, the hour after the Hour of the Time, which is Quest for Help with Michael Cottingham. And Friday Night Live with Gary Bourgeois and Dean. And coming up very shortly, and I'll preview it tomorrow night, will be a new broadcast that we will be airing every Saturday night for 2 hours. And we'll be expanding our broadcasting all the time, ladies and gentlemen. It is important that you listen to each and every broadcast that's aired on the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. It is important that you thank Swiss America Trading for sponsoring the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network and all of its programming, and especially for sponsoring the Hour of the Time with William Cooper for the last going on 5 years now. Through hell or high water, they've been there. When the enemy burned WWCR to the ground to prevent me from broadcasting the truth from Waco, Texas, while those poor people in that church known as the Branch Davidian were being literally massacred, Swiss America Trading never, ever failed in their obligations to this broadcast. 1-800-289-2646. And while you're at it, ask them how you can get your hands on some real money. Don't be afraid to discuss how much money you can afford to spend. Whether you purchase one silver dollar or one $20 gold piece, it doesn't matter. It is a step toward the preservation of the assets that you've worked all your life to obtain. You don't want to lose them. Because if the stock market goes down the tubes, if all of a sudden the paper money is discovered to be the fraud that it is, and absolutely runs away with inflation, if you have real money, gold or silver coin, you will be protected as those throughout history have been protected by the ownership of precious metals in coinage form. 1-800-289-2646 or 1-800-BUY-COIN. Do it now. You'll be so glad that you did. It's 1-800-289-2646. 2646. COINTELPRO papers also exposes, with the FBI's own documents, very own documents, the case of Hollywood actress Jean Seberg, who was, according to a May 6, 1970 memo from FBI headquarters to special agent in charge of Los Angeles, quote, a financial supporter of the Black Panther Party and should be neutralized, end quote. Bureau documents reveal that the Los Angeles office fabricated a letter suggesting that Seberg, although married to actor Romaine Gary, was carrying the baby of a prominent Black Panther, and that the letter was sent to the L.A. Press. The Los Angeles Times gossip columnist, Joyce Haber, took the bait and printed the story, which reportedly led to Seberg's taking an overdose of sleeping pills, causing her to prematurely deliver her baby, which died 2 days later. Seberg, whom the FBI knew to be, quote, emotionally unstable and in the care of a psychiatrist before the operation began, end quote, ultimately succeeded in committing suicide after making yearly attempts on the anniversary of the baby's death. Gary, by then her ex-husband, also took his life shortly after her death. COINTELPRO's Psy War techniques also included some ridiculous items, such as the anonymous mailing of bizarre one-page non-sequiturs designed to harass and destabilize the personalities of the targeted leader. For instance, one New Left figure received a letter which depicted a crude sketch of a beetle with the words, quote, beware the Siberian beetle, end quote. A cartoon directed at a member of the Black Panthers suggested that he was next on a hit list shown being crossed off by a government thug. And you bought the story, ladies and gentlemen, that when we called the BATF, jack-booted Nazi thugs, that somehow we were the ones who were wrong. The COINTELPRO papers is written by apparent leftists and studiously fails to expose the simultaneous COINTELPRO targeting of the right wing, or the supposed right wing, what they call the right wing, which has escalated in the last 5 years. An illustrated example is from the early 70s when a segregationist named Byron D. La Beckwith, having been acquitted of the murder of Black civil rights leader Medgar Evers, was targeted by the FBI for a ruthless frame-up. He was arrested while driving down the highway after the FBI had planted a ticking bomb in the back seat of his car. It was alleged that he was on his way to kill A.I. Botnick, a prominent Jewish Anti-Defamation League leader. Even though witnesses said he had pulled off the road and slept for 2 hours just prior to his being arrested, the alleged ticking time bomb in the back seat apparently didn't cause insomnia. How do we know that he was framed? Well, ladies and gentlemen, last year, Bill Stringer and I broke this story on the hour of the time. I read his transcript verbatim, first time anywhere. It was a scoop on the world. He was a terminally ill FBI agent, an agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, came forward. He admitted that his boss and an associate had framed De La Beck with by planting the explosives in his car. I had obtained a copy of Stringer's October 18, 1995 sworn deposition before Judge W.O. Dillard of the 5th Chancery Court District of the State of Mississippi, in which he states that in 1973 in Jackson, Mississippi, quote, I was summoned to the office of Roy K. Moore, who was at that time the special agent in charge of the Jackson Division of the FBI, end quote. He claims Moore, quote, desired for me to assist Special Agent Tommy Webb in the case by assisting Webb in getting some sticks of dynamite into the automobile of Mr. Beckwith, end quote. And I read the entire transcript of this deathbed testimony on the air, ladies and gentlemen, testimony that was in a sworn deposition before Judge W.O. Dillard of the 5th Chancery Court District of the State of Mississippi, a legal document. Stringer refused, saying, quote, I absolutely would not set up Mr. Beckwith or any other person in an illegal manner, end quote. Moore then ordered him to do it and threatened to double his workload. Moore still refused, and Agent Webb's work was reassigned to him a few months later, according to Stringer. Quote, Special Agent Webb stated that he used a key to Mr. Beckwith's car, which he had previously obtained, and entered Mr. Beckwith's car, at which time he placed several sticks of dynamite, an alarm clock, and a battery on the floor of Mr. Beckwith's automobile behind the driver's seat. He stated that he then closed and relocked the doors to Mr. Beckwith's car, end quote. Stringer recounts that Webb then radioed to police to pull over De La Beckwith, who was falsely convicted and spent 3 years in jail for transporting explosives. Although he had opposed the plan, he kept quiet about it for over 2 decades. When Stringer finally began talking about the frame-up in recent years, he received veiled threats from fellow agents. Can you imagine this, ladies and gentlemen? This is not the FBI that I believed in when I was a child and wanted so much to become an agent of the FBI. I used to write happy birthday letters to J. Edgar Hoover. He used to write me a thank you letter back. This, ladies and gentlemen, is more akin to the Russian KGB or Hitler's German Gestapo. How many more such passive accomplices to similar crimes are there inside our secret police agencies? And don't you dare for a moment believe that they're not the secret police. Edward L. Bernays learned how to manipulate the minds of enemy soldiers from his work as a psychological operations specialist in World War I. You see, this is not new. Later, the renowned father of public relations talked of creating pseudo-events in order to better sell products or advance public affairs objectives. He even wrote a book in 1955 entitled, quote, The Engineering of Consent, end quote, University of Oklahoma Press. Now, in the nasty 90s, without various symbolic and even contrived media pseudo-events, the nation's change engineers would be unable to properly condition the American public into hating the enemies of authoritarian, totalitarian socialism. And that is the way they are going about creating a nation-destroying world government. A nation-destroying world government. A nation-destroying world government. Consider all of the instances that I have just quoted to you of U.S. law enforcement's illegal tactics and the way they are used to mobilize public opinion. Don't you think it's interesting that although Robert Starr and James McCraney's arrests were accorded front page coverage, the explosive revelations of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms treachery were tightly blacked out from all but the local Macon newspaper and a few scant references in Atlanta papers? Don't you think it interesting that CBS News, the source of the widely dispersed report that the conspirators intended to bomb the Olympics, refused to retract the statement when it was proven to be not true? Check the Macon Telegraph of April 30th, 1996. CBS News stood by their story even when the Justice Department and defense attorneys refuted it. Might this be because the original source was from within the government? A, quote, reliable source, end quote? Don't you think it's frightening that although there were reporters from around the country present at the preliminary hearing, that you didn't hear it on the nightly news or read it in the morning paper? Could it be that in order for a media pseudo event to achieve the desired psycho-political effect, the full story must remain a secret? The loud lie has to resonate across the globe while the whispered truth is confined to the well-informed fringes and the masses, the herds of sheeple. Follow the Judas goat to the shearing pens, and from there up the ramp to the slaughterhouse. This is not, ladies and gentlemen, an isolated incident. It is not. You may recall that when Ted Koppel told the world on the night of April the 21st, 1995, that an unnamed government source had informed ABC News that Timothy McVeigh was a member of the Michigan militia. Do you remember that? You see, that was the loud lie, the loud lie, the loud lie. It took weeks of straining to hear the whispered truth before even a limited, very small number of Americans learned that the connection was bogus. You see, the FBI issued a statement that there was no militia connection, that neither Nichols nor McVeigh were members of any militia, and there was no widespread militia conspiracy. But the damage had already been done, and mountain ranges of mendacity were built upon that one statement, that one lie. In fact, over a year later, that initial indelible impression still fuels the irrational and unethical smearing of the militia movement, constitutionalists, and the entire right wing. The dissemination of this loud lie has become a science in itself, led by groups like the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith and the Southern Poverty Law Center and radical left experts like Chip Burlett. This country is now beginning to undergo another phase in the psycho-political brainwashing process. Anyone who opposes the government's unprecedented encroachments on our creator-endowed unalienable rights, or who fights blatant government corruption, such as the Vincent Foster, meaner drug running, or Oklahoma bombing cover-ups, is automatically and mercilessly branded as an anti-government extremist. Of course, what these very slick con artists and their shills in the corporate media fail to tell the trusting public is that the targeted groups are fighting government corruption. And the only reason they can be cast as extreme is that so few of their compatriots are equal to that task. See, most people, ladies and gentlemen, are cowards. Do they know it? What the major news networks who interview these self-anointed paragons of, quote, tolerance, end quote, don't tell you about them is that not only are they intolerant, they are themselves radical extremists of the left-wing variety, or if COINTELPRO is any indication, perhaps even government operatives. As I have related in the June-July 1995 relevance, some of the extremists were exposed by liberal archivist Laird Wilcox of the Wilcox Editorial Research Service in Olathe, Kansas. You see, Wilcox wrote that Chip Burlett was, quote, a founding member of Chicago Friends of Albania, which acts as an unregistered agent for one of the most repressive communist regimes on the face of the earth, end quote. But Peter Jennings just had Mr. Burlett on ABC News warning that right-wingers were planning to use the Internet to facilitate heinous acts of sabotage across the nation. Unfortunately, Mr. Jennings forgot to mention that Burlett once wrote for The Guardian, the hardcore Marxist-Leninist news weekly of which Wilcox wrote in a March 1989 report, and I quote, "A cursory review of its pages reveals hard, hateful, vengeful, and strident Marxist, Leninist, and pro-totalitarian content. Issue after issue rhapsodizes about the achievements of one totalitarian single-party state after another," end quote. But Chip Burlett, Peter Jennings' expert, is supposed to be fighting groups who hate. You go figure. The enigmatic Mr. Burlett should know about totalitarian police state tactics and government officials who hate. You see, he contributed a guide to the FBI documents in the above-referenced book about that subject, the COINTELPRO papers. And when you see him on television, you think that he's an expert on terrorism, hate groups, white supremacists. Oh, what fools these mortals be. Another oft-quoted anti-hate group is the Center for Democratic Renewal, the CDR, in Atlanta, whose Dan Levitas seems to specialize in venomous assaults on the right, frequently heard on mainstream programs such as Nightline. Among the CDR's principals over the years have been the extremist left-wing radicals Lenny Zeskind, Lynn Wells, and Ann Braden. According to Laird Wilcox, Zeskind was, quote, on the editorial board of Urgent Tasks, Journal of the Revolutionary Left, publication of the small, Chicago-based Marxist-Leninist group, the Sojourner Truth Organization, end quote. Lynn Wells, a longtime associate of Zeskind, aligned herself with the Atlanta-based Georgia Communist League and merged into the October League, which in June of 1977 became the Communist Party Marxist-Leninist CPML, one of the most radical, hardcore, extreme left-wing groups on the American political spectrum. We will continue this tomorrow night. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. God bless each and every single one of you. This is the Voice of Freedom.